Hello, this is Mary Lou Falcone. I'm a classical music publicist and strategist, and also an advocate for Lewy body dementia. And you're listening to Follow Your Dream with Robert Miller.
Everyone has a dream. Robert Miller is a musician who had a dream to become a rock star. He followed his dream and he succeeded. If you're ready to pursue and succeed at your dream, then listen up and get inspired and motivated to take action today. Welcome to the Follow Your Dream podcast.
The sky.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the award-winning Follow Your Dream podcast with listeners worldwide in 200 countries. I'm Robert Miller, your host. My guest today is Elaine Martone. For many years, a top producer and production head for classical and jazz at Telarc Records. As a producer, she's a five-time Grammy winner. She worked with the Atlanta Symphony, the Cleveland Orchestra, Jerry Allen, Oscar Peterson, and McCoy Tyner, among others. How about that? She also ran the production department at Telarc. And in that capacity, she managed more than 1,500 projects. How crazy is that? And in her spare time, she produced the Ojai Music Festival for 7 years. And now with her own company, she's produced Grammy-nominated recordings by singer Tierney Sutton, among others. She is a Wonder Woman. And in the middle of this episode, as I do with all my musical guests, Elaine and I are going to do a song fest. I've got a handful of works that she's given me. We'll play a little bit of them. We'll talk about them. You'll get the backstories, and nobody else does this in podcasts. And you know that I like to feature a song of mine in every episode underneath the introduction and at the end, and I always try to make it relevant somehow to my guest. And in this instance, I have chosen as my featured song, my cover of a Miles Davis classic, All Blues, sung by the late, great John Lucien. This is a track from Miles Behind, my lost but now found 1994 debut album. It's a classic jazz song that fits with so many of the jazz artists and albums associated with Elaine. So, Elaine Martone, welcome to the Follow Your Dream podcast.
Hello, Robert. So great to be with you.
Fabulous to have you. Now, listen, I always like to go through people's bios and pick out something that just hits me. Sometimes it's obscure. And with your bio, what jumped out at me was that you got trained on the oboe. Is that right?
That's right. I have a degree in oboe performance from Ithaca College. And that's sort of how I wound my way over from Ithaca, New York to Cleveland, Ohio, because I've always admired and loved the Cleveland Orchestra. Always. And so I came here because I wanted to study with oboists in the Cleveland Orchestra. And in the meantime, after I graduated from college, while I was studying here in Cleveland, I found out that Telarc Records, which was a fledgling record company back then in 1980, Telarc started in 1977, needed somebody to do a bunch of different things. And I went in, interviewed with Bob Woods, who is now my husband, and Jack Renner, who passed away in 2019, Bob's partner. I interviewed with them on an August day in 1990, and they offered me the job a couple days later.
Isn't that great? Okay, but go back to the oboe for a second. Did you want to be a performer on the oboe? Was that what your goal was at that time?
Yeah, so my goal was to be an orchestral musician, and the Cleveland Orchestra was my favorite orchestra. It's great full circle experience because I produce for the Cleveland Orchestra now. I'm very happy to do it because, like I said, it is my favorite orchestra. But I really wanted to be a performing musician. I had terrible stage fright, though. So stage fright and being a performing musician do not go well together. I'm a much better record producer than I ever was an oboe player, although I was a decent oboe player. I tried playing jazz oboe for a little minute in college, but couldn't make it swing.
That didn't work for you, huh? You know, some people ask me all the time about music. They say, you know, does music help kids get into college? And I said, if you want to go into Harvard, Yale, or one of those schools, teach your kid how to play the oboe, the bassoon, or the French horn, okay? Because there's always openings.
Or maybe viola.
Yeah, there you go. I didn't do that myself with my kids, but it worked out okay for them. Listen, I love the oboe. I love the fact that you were a performer like that. But as you said, sometimes in life, you just recognize that that's not the path for you. And maybe there's another path that's related. And that's what happened with you. You went into the record business when there was a record business.
That's right. CDs weren't even invented yet, but they were just coming, right? We could see which way it was going. So the thing that was cool about Telarc was that Bob and Jack had the vision to stockpile digital masters. So they were recording in digital technology before CD even came in. So Telarc was lined up to be on the cutting edge, not just the audiophile cutting edge, that is making recordings that people who love their stereo systems or their audio systems could use, but also lined up to provide interesting repertoire and, you know, sometimes meat and potatoes repertoire that people, when you're rebuilding a catalog, would be able to use. And it was so much fun to be really on the ground floor of that opportunity.
I can imagine. And also with Telarc, you had this kind of bifurcated focus between classical and jazz, which was very unusual, okay, for a smaller independent label. How did that come about?
Oh, that's a really great question, Robert. So Telarc did strictly classical with one jazz release, Mel Lewis, Thad Jones Big Band, very, very early on. That was actually before I started there, but there was that recording. And then we were recording Andre Previn with the Philharmonia Orchestra in England, in London. And also he was at that time music director of the LA Phil. But as you know about Andre Previn, not only was he a really great conductor, he was also a composer. He was an arranger.
And a piano player.
He was a classical and jazz pianist. The man really could do anything. And so after one of his recordings in LA, Bob asked Andre if he would go back to playing jazz. And Andre had not done a jazz recording in 25 years. As a matter of fact, at the first session we did with Andre, I brought him my copy of his West Side Story release, right, on Contempo. Do you remember that record?
I remember the record.
It was one of my favorites, and I asked him to sign it, and he signed it, you know, to Elaine, thanks for asking me about this 25 years later. Well, that was in 1989. So that's when we got into, Telarc got into jazz in 1989. Jazz music, like classical music, primarily acoustic music. So we were well poised to make a great recording with him, which we did. Andre's condition of going back to jazz after 25 years was we got get him the greatest sidemen. So we got him Ray Brown and Joe Pass.
That was a pretty good sidemen for sure.
Right. That was really good.
You know, what's really interesting is that there are only really, to my mind, a handful of great artists that could toggle between classical and jazz. And I'm thinking of Wynton Marsalis, who is extraordinary in that ability, because the classical side is so technically oriented and you're reading the notes that are on the page and you've got to play everything perfectly. And the jazz side is like the other side of the brain.
Right.
It's the interpretive. It's the, you know, the side that's kind of doing its own thing, if you will. And very few artists can do that, in my opinion, very successfully. Andre Previn was one of the first.
He was really amazing at it. So on the second Andre Previn recording we did, the first one was out in LA. The second was in New York at the Academy of Arts and Letters you know, Uptown. That's what we called it, Uptown.
Okay.
And we were recording Andre Ray Brown, and that was Mundell Lowe on guitar. And Ray Brown said to Bob and me, well, if you think this is great, you should come downtown tonight and hear me play with Oscar Peterson.
Uh-huh.
So we went downtown after the sessions in the day, down to the Blue Note, and there's Oscar, Ray Brown, Herb Ellis, and Bob and Jack went up to Oscar and said, you know, we'd like to record with you. And Oscar said, yes. And the next week, they were there for 2 weeks. The next week, we went in and recorded and made 5 different recordings out of that week-long set that they were doing. It was incredible. And that's how we got launched into jazz.
You know, I'm not sure if you know this. I've talked about it a little bit on the program. And that is, I used to co-own a jazz label. It was called 32 Records. And we had an imprint called 32 Jazz. We bought the output of Muse Records, which was a catalog in New York City in the 1980s that, you know, recorded all the great guys that were playing at that time. So for a time, you know, we were trying to be out there with jazz music. And jazz, as you know, and for the audience's benefit, it's a niche market, okay? It's about 5% or so of the overall output of recordings. But jazz aficionados will go to every length possible to get hold of the great music that all the different labels were putting out. So kudos to you that you got Telarc to go into that jazz area.
It was really fun. And jazz has always been one of my loves. So I felt really, really lucky to get to work with the legends.
Well, you had Oscar Peterson, you had McCoy Tyner, and we're going to play one of those pieces in the Songfest portion. I mean, these are fabulous musicians, okay? Good for you that you did that. All right, so I want to hear also about this production side of things, okay? Because you were wearing 2 hats, right? You were a producer, and yet you were in charge of production. So tell us what that meant.
So I started at Telarc when there were, I think, 7 people. And because we came at the advent of the CD technology, there was a great opportunity to build a department, right? So I got the extreme joy of building a production team. And by the end of the Telarc years, we had 12 people in our production department. We had a stable of producers and engineers, and we had an art department, and we had licensing, and we had so much fun because they were people that were highly motivated. It was a mom and pop operation. So we all got a say-so in how things were going, which was really amazing. It was a very loving company. You always felt like supported in not just your musical goals, but also like your life goals as things change in people's lives. It was here in Cleveland. So Cleveland is an easy place to live. It's easy to get around. You can afford a house. You know, as long as you travel and go to New York and London and LA, Chicago, France, whatever, you can have a really, really wonderful quality of life here. And I feel like we built this great company. So I ran the production department. I just, you know, would really pick people who were highly motivated and loved what we were doing. And so I got to really craft that in a way. And that was so much fun. With the demise of Telarc, 42 of 50 of us lost our jobs in 2009. We sold our company in 2005 to Concord Music Group. Concord was into jazz. They were like a competitor, but they had their sights set on much, much bigger things. And they've gone on to still, you know, they're still there in different permutations, really, I'd say, thriving, kind of at the destruction of Telarc. They kind of took it over, and then there's really no more releases on the Telarc imprint, except maybe Hiromi, who is a jazz pianist who is fantastic.
Yes. You know, the whole record industry changed tremendously, and it changed right around the turn of the century. Okay. Everything went from LPs, then to CDs. And then, as you remember, kids started stripping out the music off of CDs, and Napster came around.
That's right.
And the music industry went after all these kids that were doing it. It was probably a big mistake because it just pushed it all underground even further. Now, of course, you've got an industry that's a shell of what it was at one time because everything is streaming, which most of us can't stand anymore. But, you know, what are you going to do?
Exactly. So we lost the ability to monetize what we were doing. And so we had to figure out, you know, what was next. So after we lost our jobs at Telarc, which included my husband.
I was going to say what was next was to sell the label, which was the right thing to do.
Because that was where our assets were, right? What could have been next was to severely downsize the company and take it back to, you know, instead of 50 people, 5 people. We didn't want to do that because we were very loyal to our employees who had been very loyal to us. So at the end of the day, who knows what was the right thing? I really loved working for a record label. And when Telarc imploded, I asked my husband, Bob, so we're going to start another label, right? And he said, uh-uh. But we did come up with the name Sonarc Music for our production company, Sonarc being son of Telarc. Uh-huh. Son of. And Bob went on to do archival preservation work, but I still wanted to produce. And so I became a freelance producer, but concurrently met Tom Morris, who I'd known. He ran the Cleveland Orchestra. He was CEO of the Cleveland Orchestra and the Boston Symphony. He had retired from the Cleveland Orchestra, but he was running the Ojai Music Festival, but he was also creating with 2 partners in New York, Mary Lou Falcone, who I know you know, and David Yes. Foster, who was president of Opus 3 Artists. We created Spring for Music, which was an orchestra music festival out of Carnegie Hall. And Tom talked to me and asked me if I would want to be the producer for that, to which I said, I have no idea what that meant. He said, well, come talk to my partners and we'll see if, you know, you're a good fit. And then he handed me a job description and I looked at it and I said, did you write this job description for me? Because this is exactly what I would do. And we had so much fun running a festival out of Carnegie Hall 1 week a year in May. 6 orchestras would come through with adventurous program. Every seat in Carnegie Hall was $25. We did that for 4 years, but we did not get funding for it after that. And Tom Morris, in his wisdom, said, let's declare victory and walk away, which we did.
Enough is enough. Good for you.
So I got to run that and work with him as a festival producer for the Ojai Music Festival. That was really cool. I had no idea what I was doing in either of those jobs, but I figured it out.
You know, the definition of an expert, they say, is somebody that's done something once. Okay. So when you did that first Ojai Festival, you became an expert in running a festival. That's the way I would look at it. Hi, everybody. This is Robert Miller, your host. You know, one of the many benefits to me of doing this podcast is being able to collaborate musically with some of my guests who are among the best musicians in the world. My first collaboration was with the great Jim Peterik, of the Ides of March, and formerly with Survivor. Jim and I collaborated on The Fall of Winter, a song about a blue-collar worker who dreams of a better life. Also contributing was Elliot Randall, the renowned guitarist. John Helliwell was the amazing saxophonist in Supertramp, one of the greatest bands of the rock era. John collaborated with me on my 2023 album, Bobby M. and the Paisley Parade, and he's featured on several tracks. One of them is This Time. Tony Carey is a singer-songwriter and keyboard genius who played with Ritchie Blackmore's Rainbow. Tony has collaborated with me on several recordings, including his exquisite organ playing on All of the Time. I want you all of the time. I need you all of the time. And I'm finishing up a new collaboration right now with trumpeter Randy Brecker, formerly with Blood, Sweat, and Tears. Collaborations like these make the podcast very special indeed. As always, thank you for listening and keep on rocking. All right, let's move on to the Songfest portion of this interview because I want to make sure we get some music into this whole thing. And the first thing that we're playing right now underneath my voice is Illuminations. This is McCoy Tyner's 2004 LP with Telarc. It's got Christian McBride on the bass, Lewis Nash on the drums. Tell us a little bit about this. And a lady named Elaine Martone was the producer, if I understand.
So, you know, you can imagine producing McCoy Tyner. There is no producing, right?
That's right.
My job was to kind of run the session, make sure everything went well. Every now and then, maybe I would pipe in with a comment about ensemble or, you know, let's go back and try this again. And Christian and Lewis, I mean, who else do you need for your rhythm section, right?
Yeah, these are top guys in the entire world. You could probably just sit back as producer and say, okay, yeah, McCoy, would everything okay? You want some coffee or something like that?
Do we need to break for food?
Just tell them when the red light goes on.
Exactly. So, you know, keep track of how each tune and the timings and which takes were good and stay out of the way.
There you go.
One thing about being a producer is to know when you don't need to say anything and to shut up.
Did you find as a producer that your musical background was a big advantage for you?
Absolutely. So, you know, as a jazz producer, not so much because I do not read chord changes. Plus, you're not looking at charts, right? You're using your ears. But as a classical producer, you must know how to read music. You have to be able to talk to the musicians in their language and respond to what's going on in the real time. That's one of your main jobs. Your other main job is to establish trust. And I think both of those things really came to me from studying oboe, playing in ensembles, and really listening. But the other thing I liked to play was the turntable. So I like to be in charge of what other people were listening to. So I think that somehow I developed both my taste and my opinions by doing that. So another thing about being a producer is you have to have a point of view on things. You can't be wishy-washy and you have to be clear, but you have to be also thoughtful and give guidance and direction. That's what people are looking to you for. They're not looking to you for, that's great, let's do it again. But they're looking for, what didn't you like about it?
I'm curious about what you just said. And that is, I know what it's like to record jazz because that's what I play and I've been involved in so many of those sessions. But with an orchestra, you've got, you know, I don't know, 60, 80 musicians in a gigantic room. Do you do it one time or do you do it multiple times? How does that work?
So in general, you do a complete take and then you call a break and you have the conductor or the artist, whatever. If it's chamber music, it's different than if it's an orchestral piece. If it's orchestra, you invite the conductor in, any musicians who can come listen, have people listen. And with the score, you and the conductor are going over what worked and what didn't work and what you need to go back and fix. So then you send the artist out and you kind of work through it systematically. For me, it's like building a house. You know, you start at the foundation and you just keep working your way up through the levels. And it's really, really fun. I'm excellent at keeping organized and knowing how to call the time in a session, which is very critical in an orchestral session because you're working with a clock and you're working in America on union time.
Are you punching in to those sections that maybe the conductor didn't like, or are you starting from the beginning and going through the whole piece again?
Yeah, so you're starting from the beginning and working your way through. And then I put a roadmap in on what takes I want to use, from like measure one is going to be take three to measure four, and then beat two of measure four, you're going to go into take 14, like that. And so we're not punching in, we're actually editing in, which is different than doing punch-ins. You can do punch-ins, but it's not efficient in classical music.
Okay. Well, you just cleared up something that I always wondered about. So I thank you very much for that. All right. Let's go to the second piece that you gave to me. This is Transmigration. This is the Atlanta Symphony. This is a very unusual piece. You need to explain this, because they're reading out names at the beginning. Tell us a little bit about what that's about.
Okay, so this piece is called On the Transmigration of Souls, and it's written by John Adams. And it was written in 2002, premiered by the New York Phil. This recording is with the Atlanta Symphony, Robert Spano, and the Atlanta Symphony Orchestra and Chorus. The piece was written in response to 9/11. So the names that are being called out by that child in the beginning are names of people who are missing. And they remember the posters put up in the city listed, you know, all the people that we couldn't find. I'm going to start crying. So before I recorded this piece, I had to listen to it. There was a New York Phil recording. I had to listen to it 10 or more times, because you can't cry and produce. It's like crying when you're playing.
There's no crying in baseball, and there's no crying in producing.
Exactly. So you might want your audience to cry, but you have to be, you know, it's hard to listen with your ears while you're in a very highly emotional state, right? So that's what you're hearing in the beginning of this piece, that child reading out the names of people missing. At that session, John Adams, the composer, was sitting behind me, and I had said to the chorus, there's a part where the people, you can hear people running down the stairs. There's a recorded track that's under the performance that we're doing, under the music. And you can hear people walking downstairs. And I said to the chorus, I said, chorus, that's the part where, you know, you're really agitated because you're running through the city trying to find your people. And John Adams got on the mic. He's like, that is not what's happening there, Elaine. What's happening there is people are coming down the steps of the World Trade Center, and they don't even know what's going on yet. So they're not frantic, and that's the wrong emotion you're asking the chorus to convey. So I had to get on the mic to the 180 people in the Atlanta Symphony Orchestra chorus and said, chorus, I've given you misdirection here.
Well, you know, it's interesting, because when I was listening to the piece and you're hearing these names, it's very somber at the beginning with these names being read off. And there's nothing that tells you, at least I didn't hear it, that says this was a 9/11 list of people.
Right.
But I was going to say to you, when I was introducing this, it sounded like they were reading off people that had passed away. And I guess that's exactly what it was.
Exactly, Robert. You know, that's one of the things about doing things only online. You don't see the liner notes. So the piece was written by John Adams for the New York Phil to be performed in 2002 on the anniversary of 9/11, right?
I see.
It's a very powerful piece. It's very near and dear to my heart.
I can imagine. All right, let's go to the third one. This one is called Millennium Canticles. Third Coast is doing this. This one I thought was kind of really out there. Thank you. Tell us what this is all about.
So this is a piece written by Missy Mazzoli, a great composer, for Third Coast Percussion. Third Coast Percussion is four percussionists. I think they've been in business for 15 years. I've produced three records for them. They've won a Grammy and they are Grammy nominated. They're fantastic.
What did they win a Grammy in? What was the title?
Best Small Ensemble.
Okay.
I think they won it for a Philip Glass recording that I didn't do, but they've been nominated many, many times. They are just fantastic. I love this piece. I think it's so clever and interestingly composed, but also the aesthetic of the group is just fantastic. They, you know, percussionists have to sort of play on, they learn to play on their instruments and so forth, but they also invent all kinds of things to make sounds on. So this to me is a really highly creative process. This recording has overdubs because there's a bunch of other percussion instruments we had to slip in there. So very labor intensive, but so much fun.
It's definitely different for sure. Okay. And I appreciate your explanation there. All right. We're going to go to the last one. This is Suite from Der Rosenkavalier. I don't know if I pronounced that correctly. It's a Richard Strauss piece by the Cleveland Orchestra.
Perfect pronunciation.
Tell us about this one.
So Rosenkavalier is one of my favorite operas. I was late to the opera game. It took me a while to have a love for it and not just worry that I didn't understand the language, because as one of my friends said, well, what language is a violin speak in, right? So music is music. And right. This also really touches my heart. Franz Welser-Most is the conductor of he's the music director of the Cleveland Orchestra. I work with him a lot. He is Austrian. Strauss was Austrian. This piece is just, I call it one of Franz's party pieces because he does it so well. I think that the Cleveland Orchestra, the way they play as an ensemble, really sets the standard for what I want to hear in orchestral music. And this was really one of my favorite things I've recorded with them.
Well, it's a lovely piece. And of course, Strauss is a very well-known composer. So kudos to you that you did this one.
Thank you.
We have been speaking here with Elaine Martone, who has had a remarkable career at Telarc Records and then as a producer of a festival and then on her own. Elaine, I want to thank you so much for being on this podcast. It's been just great.
Robert, you're fantastic. Thank you so much for what you do and for your interest. I really appreciate you.
Thank you so much. And now we're going to listen to that song that started off the episode. It's my version of a Miles Davis song called All Blues, sung by the late, great John Lucien. I want to thank you all for listening, and we'll see you in the next episode.
Thanks for listening to the Follow Your Dream podcast. Make sure to subscribe, rate, and review the podcast so you don't miss another inspiring episode. You can connect with Robert at robert@followyourdreampodcast.com. And you can hear more from his band at projectgrandslam.com.
The sea, the sky, and you and I. Sea and sky, and you and I are all. All shades, all hues, all blues. Some blues are sad, and some are glad. Dark and sad, or bright and glad, they're all. Thank you. all shapes, all hues, all blues. A color, the blues are more than a color. There are a mount of pain, a taste of strife, a sad refrain against which life is played. Blues can be the living dues we all got to pay. Summer's day that's there, a prayer that's prayed, lament that's made, a goodbye sad. Some shades of blue is there, blue heaven, blue, all blues. The sea, the sky, and you and I, sea and sky, and you and I are all blue, all shades, all hues, they are